This is Audible.
ISIS Audiobooks presents an unabridged recording of A to Z of Hell, Ross Kemp's How Not to Travel the World, written by Ross Kemp, read by Mark Meadows. The moral right of the author has been asserted. Introduction. My dedicated team and I have been making documentaries for nigh on 10 years now, and during that time we've become incredibly close, fallen out, made up, laughed, cried, and come face to face with some of the very worst aspects of humanity. One thing I know for sure, I wouldn't be here now, 5 coffees down and 4 Kit Kats to the good, if it wasn't for that team. I want to thank them all from the bottom of my heart, and everyone at Sky for giving us the freedom and support to make the films we want to make. As I sit here writing with my editor, Ben Dunn, looking over my shoulder, I remember that I originally wanted to call this book The A to Z of What Not to Do, because, given the option of doing the right or the wrong thing, I have generally chosen the latter. And amazingly, most of those bad decisions have happened off the screen. So this book hopefully captures those moments you don't see on TV. However, as you can tell, I often don't get my own way. Others may disagree. So my editor insisted we call it The A to Z of Hell for commercial reasons. So if you have purchased this book, he was right and I was wrong. If you haven't, then I was wrong again. Whatever's on the front cover, this book is an honest, sometimes tragic, and at times, hopefully amusing account of what happens when a hyperactive 40-something-year-old man gets given the opportunity to travel the world and make documentaries. And as far as I'm concerned, long may it continue. Ross Kemp, Ben Dunn's office, Penguin Random House, Pimlico, 1821, the 25th of February, 2014. A is for Avez-vous le Boeuf? Grade 2 CSE is the extent of my French, but even so, I know what Avez-vous le Boeuf meant. It meant a pair of hungry, angry, and possibly stoned Congolese guys were coming to get me. Or at least it did on the night in question. We were in the east of the Democratic Republic of the Congo for a film in the second series of Extreme World. It was the first time I'd returned to a genuine war zone since Afghanistan, and it would prove to be an eye-opening, not to mention distressing experience, mainly because of the sexual violence associated with the war. Not only is the war in the Congo the bloodiest conflict since the end of the Second World War, with around 6 million dead since 1998, but almost 400,000 women are raped there every year. Horrifically, brutally raped. It is, according to the UN, the rape capital of the world. It's ironic how many countries with democratic in their name, many of which I've been to, clearly aren't. Because the Eastern DRC is technically a war zone, there are no commercial flights in and out, so we had to reach it by road from neighbouring Rwanda. That was fitting, because it's in Rwanda that the roots of the Congolese conflict lie, the immediate roots anyway. When, in 1994, during an attempted genocide that shocked the world, the Hutu tribe tried to ethnically cleanse Rwanda of Tutsis. The Tutsis rose up against the Hutus and forced 2 million of them, including some of the ringleaders of the original uprising, to flee the country. And where did they go? They took the same road we did when we made our way from Rwanda into the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. It was quite a journey, going from one country where the fighting and barbarism has drawn to a close into another where it continues to rage to this day. In terms of the change from one to the other, it was like leaving Switzerland and finding yourself in Hades. For as we drove around the outskirts of Lake Kivu, still in Rwanda, we saw no signs of conflict. No barbed wire, no rubble, no half-demolished homes. Not even the piles of plastic you seem to encounter everywhere else in Africa. Then we entered the Congo. And what a difference. Rubbish, barbed wire and rubble were everywhere. We'd seen very few guns in Rwanda, But here in the Congo, it seemed as though every other guy was carrying the Congolese police, army, UN peacekeeping troops in their distinctive blue helmets. We're talking about the largest deployment of UN troops in the world in the Congo, and there were a lot of guns being carried around. By the time we reached the border crossing, we were already mourning the comparative beauty of Rwanda. We clambered down from our land cruisers at a white, old colonial French-style building, and I wandered up to a couple of bored-looking cops in shades. See, K is for kit. "Bonjour," I said, smiling. "Ça va?" The cops scowled and led us around the back of the building to an office, where they quizzed us about the reasons for our visit. "We're journalists," we told them. "We're trying to do a story on the Congo."
"What story?
What story?" Absolutely paranoid, these guys, like something from the Deer Hunter, wanting to know what story we were planning to cover. Not far away was a grill, thick bars in the ground, with hands poking through and prisoners inside babbling away in pidgin English. I'd heard them when we passed. "Help me, help me." And I'd looked at them nervously, feeling a mix of sympathy and a keen sense of not wanting to join them down there, fully aware we were being treated with extreme suspicion by the cops. You could hardly blame them. The tribal problems in the Congo are made worse by the fact that it's so mineral-rich. If you use a laptop, a mobile phone, or a computer game, then you're making use of coltan and cassiterite that may well have been mined in the Congo. 2/3 of the world's coltan comes from the Congo, in fact. You'd hope that sitting on top of huge reserves of minerals used by the vast majority of the Western world would be a good thing for the regular Congolese, and that some of the wealth generated by those mines might trickle down. Well, as I was about to find out, it isn't, and it doesn't. So, like I say, you could hardly blame the border guards for treating a bunch of guys from the West with suspicion. Historically, it was blokes like us who came into their country, took what we wanted, and left a god-awful mess in our wake. During the first portion of our stay in the Congo, we visited Panzi Hospital, run by the remarkable Dr. Dennis Mukwege. There I got to meet some of the victims of rape and sexual violence. I knew the rapes in the Congo were brutal, but even so, nothing could have prepared me for what I was about to learn at the Panzi Hospital. Rape, I discovered, is being used as a weapon of war. Soldiers force fathers to rape their own daughters and brothers to rape sisters. Dr. Mukwege introduced me to women who had had their lower arms cut off from just above the elbow so they could never hold anything again, who had been repeatedly gang-raped, been penetrated with guns and knives, and had burning wood and molten plastic bottles pushed into them. That's how deep the hatred is. And afterwards, the poor victims are ostracized. In many, if not most, instances, they're carrying the babies of their tribe's most hated enemies. So they're rejected by their families, by other women, everybody. In the eyes of Congolese society, they've been defiled and they are effectively cast out. That was very, very hard to understand. On top of the barbarity and inhumanity of the original act comes that next insult. The fact that women who have been victims of such terrible violence are then shunned by their own families defies belief. Leaving the Panzi Hospital that day, I did a piece to camera, saying I wanted to look into the eyes of a man who was capable of doing this to another human being. And that, in the end, is what I did. See, R is for the thankfully rare glimpses of evil. First, we had to find them, which meant a UN supply flight out of Goma to Walikale, a town some way from civilization, where roads are in short supply but jungle is plentiful. Jungle that hides thousands of Hutu militiamen who wage a constant war against the UN peacekeepers, an Indian unit called the Fighting Fifth. It's their job to stop marauding militia attacking the villages, and they mount regular patrols. How do normal people get around? The answer is, they don't, unless the army escort them on the ground. No doubt about it. We were sticking close to these guys. Strapping on backpacks, and in my case, a wide-brimmed hat, we joined members of the Fighting Fifth on patrol. It was hot that day. Really, really hot. My cameraman was Jonathan Young. The sound man, a guy called John Gilbert. John, poor guy, was wearing a lot of kit, including a sound mixer strapped across his stomach. So with the mixer and whatever he had in the pack on his back, he was a long vehicle, about the length of your average Eddie Stobart. During the patrol, we reached a log that spanned a small ravine, with a river below it going to God knows where. Could have been crocodiles down there. All I knew was that I didn't want to drop down there, a fall of, what, 30 foot into the water below. But poor old John couldn't even get his leg up on the log, and for a moment he simply stood there, wobbling, lifting his leg like an oversized Thunderbird's puppet, hoping to try and make it up onto the log. Heavy bush to my right and left made it impossible for me to see either, but I steadied him and helped him up onto the log. "You're all right, mate, you're all right," I lied, thinking nothing of the sort. Quite the opposite, in fact. That the poor lad only had to overbalance by a fraction or so, and he was going to find out firsthand whatever was or was not down below. Now picture the scene. Making their way across the log were the UN escorts with the blue helmets on. After them came John, the long vehicle sound man, complete with boom. Behind him, some bloke off EastEnders. Behind him, Jonathan the cameraman. Then behind us, more UN soldiers who were tutting and sounding pissed off that we were being so slow. The UN guys were used to it, of course. The ones ahead of us scampered across with all the grace and speed of ballerinas. Us lot, on the other hand, beetled carefully forward, moving slowly but thinking we'd be okay as long as we didn't meet anything coming in the opposite direction. And that went all right for a moment or so, until we met something else coming in the opposite direction. A group of village women carrying pots and pans piled 20 foot high. The Indian soldiers ahead of us danced right round them. They seemed to defy gravity like they'd developed Spider-Man-like powers. Meanwhile, we media lovies jittered unsteadily to a halt, only to get a barrage of fresh abuse from the Indian soldiers behind, and were forced to carry on. John, the long vehicle sound man, craned his head back to give me worried eyes over his shoulder, and as we nervously approached the chattering villagers, I promised him that I would help him survive this tricky log crossing, which I did by saying, "Left a bit, John. Right a bit, John." Maybe he had something a bit more supportive in mind, but it would have to do for the time being. That was just one moment of what turned out to be a bit of a heart-in-mouth patrol. Next, we encountered members of the Congolese army. Hard-faced blokes who were as tough as any guys I'd ever met, from their narrowed, suspicious eyes right down to, well, not quite the toes of their feet, because for some reason the preferred footwear of the Congolese militia man is the white Wellington boot. I kid you not, white Wellington boots. Little dainty things. They were everywhere. It helped to take my mind off the AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenades, RPGs, they carried, the Chinese grenades hanging off their belts, and the fact that despite wearing the uniform of the Congolese army, they were former militiamen, and thus probably rapists and murderers. One of the things I've learnt about modern warfare is that contrary to what we've been led to believe by the media, it's not waged by remote control. No, wars are fought and won by men on the ground. He who controls the ground wins the war. Vietnam's a perfect example of that. Afghanistan is a perfect example of that. In Afghanistan, it's our air superiority that keeps the Taliban at bay, but the Taliban is still there at the end of the day, and will be when we've left. If you're an invader, you have a home to go back to. But if you're an inhabitant, you've got nowhere else to go, and you'll fight tooth and nail for your piece of land. That goes for the Taliban, just as it goes for the tribal divisions in the Congo. I was reminded of that as I stuck close to the UN guys, and tried not to wither under the implacable stares of the militiamen. With the patrol over, we returned to the base, and I was glad to leave the jungle, looking forward to a night in the safety and comfort of the base. Except it didn't turn out that way. Now, if you watch the film, what you hear is me saying this. Unfortunately, the UN can't put us up at their base, and we're forced to find accommodation in town, which is basic, to say the least. It has no electricity, food, or running water. But during the night, I discover it has plenty of bedbugs, mosquitoes, and rats. And that's that. The film moves on to the following day. It wasn't just bedbugs, mosquitoes, and rats I had to worry about, though. We'd been expecting to stay at the Indian UN base on a hill overlooking Walikale, but the UN guys had a sudden change of mind. It wasn't that we were unwelcome, explained the commander pleasantly enough, just that we weren't permitted to stay. However, he continued, we were quite welcome to return and have curry with them on Friday night. Nice offer, you'd think. But this was very bad news. In the meantime, we had no supplies. No food, no water, no mosquito nets. Nothing. Disgruntled and a little scared, we clambered into Mark I Land Rovers and were given a lift down the hill and into Walikale below. It was beginning to get dark, and by now we were thinking of our stomachs too. So at the director's insistence, we stopped at a couple of ramshackle stalls. Waving away a proffered fish that looked distinctly unappetizing, we opted instead for cans of tuna and corned beef each. It's not like any of us were great fans of tuna or corned beef, just that that was all they had. And believe you me, they charged us way over the odds for it, too. With that done, the Indian Army drove us to what they said was the best guest house in town. Which meant it was the only guest house in town, the only one from which we might possibly emerge alive next morning. It was located inside a compound, which, as it turned out, was guarded. Across the entrance was a dilapidated vehicle, and for a while there was a standoff between the fighting fifth and some weed-smoking militiamen hanging around outside. As it turned out, the militiamen seemed to back down. On the other hand, perhaps they were like the spiders enticing the flies. Into the trap we went, like the obedient insects that we were. The vehicle was there to protect the compound from attack, of course, but it was also going to stop us leaving, too. Second thoughts? Too late for them. With the fighting fifth waving goodbye from their departing Land Rovers, we stood near to the entrance of the guest house, surveying the groups of ne'er-do-wells lounging around the doorway. Like those we'd seen on patrol earlier, they were carrying RPGs, hand grenades, and AK-47s. Any chatter had died down to silence, and in the air hung the distinctive sweet smell of ganja as they regarded us silently from behind heavy-lidded eyes. We checked in, if handing a few dollars to an uninterested guy on reception was what you'd call checking in, then made for the bar area. In fact, it was a courtyard, featuring a table under a covered section at the far end and plastic chairs around the outside. We collected bottles of revoltingly warm beer from the bar and took our seats on the chairs, feeling uncomfortable beneath the stares of the locals. On a television, the movie Black Hawk Down was showing on a loop. In the distance, we could hear the beating of drums. They were beating down the sun. Yes, that's right. We were in a part of the world where they beat down the sun. Hungry, we used our knives to open the tins we'd bought from the ramshackle stall. Dominic, the director, had managed to get hold of a half bottle of whiskey. Before you knew it, he dragged himself to his room where he was out for the count before his head hit the pillow, successfully made comatose by the alcohol. Tom had his iPod and was consequently insulated against everything that was about to happen. The rest of us, meanwhile, me, Jonathan and John, had decided the bar was not a safe place to be. There was the small matter of being told, white men not welcome. That and the fact that the militiamen seemed to be really enjoying Black Hawk Down. These were stoned, heavily armed guys, and they were watching a war film. Call it extreme caution, although I'll call it prudence if you don't mind. But we decided to leave them to it and get the first look at our rooms, which were located on the floor above the bar. They were horrible. The walls were two-ply. There was no lock on my door, which wasn't even a proper door. It was like a saloon door, with huge gaps top and bottom, through which you could see the tops of people's heads and their legs. I had a thin blue mattress on a rickety wooden bed, still sturdier than the roof itself. I had no sleeping bag, but at least the guest house provided a mosquito net. Only trouble was you had to fix it up yourself. From nowhere, cameraman Jonathan produced a hammer and began to hammer the net to the beams above my mattress. Bad idea. From over our heads came a deluge of bug corpses that had collected in the floorboards above, raining down on us like something straight out of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Hundreds, if not thousands of them. I was still finding these things in my clothes weeks later. Recovering from the dead bug attack, we stared at the result of Jonathan's labour. A mosquito net peppered with holes you could have driven a truck through. No, let's not exaggerate. Holes that birds could have flown through. There wasn't much in it, but I had the worst room. I was thinking, I own the company and I've got the worst room. How does that work? I own the company. I should have the best fucking room. From downstairs I could hear the sound of Black Hawk Down, accompanied by raucous cheering from the stoned militiamen. Gradually it dawned on me what they were doing. They were cheering every time an American character got shot and died. I don't know if you've seen Black Hawk Down, but in it a lot of Americans get shot and die. Consequently, there was a lot of cheering coming from downstairs. It wasn't a good kind of cheering either. Upstairs, I was slathering myself in DEET in anticipation of being eaten alive by mosquitoes. I'd avoided the blue mattress so far, but even so, I swear I could feel bedbug bites already. Plus, I'd already drunk most of my water by this point and was beginning to feel dehydrated. I reached for the tin of overpriced tuna and my knife. Grappling in the dark, I found my head torch and went to work in earnest, prizing open the tin of tuna with my knife, and, as I sat there in my pants and head torch, I wondered why I'd ever left EastEnders. I found myself craving a warm dressing room, a nice egg sarnie, and a cup of tea. I held the open tin of tuna in front of the meagre light from my head torch, and inspected what could only be described as a dried biscuit, like a communion wafer of tuna, after someone had somehow sucked up all the juice inside the tin. That was the least of my problems, though. Suddenly, I badly needed a piss. God knows why I was that dehydrated, but I needed a piss. I couldn't face going to the toilet. There was a small matter of the guys downstairs. Plus, I'd already seen the state of the toilet, and it was foul. Really, really bad. Believe you me, I've had the misfortune of using some fairly rotten toilets in my time, but this one took the shit-encrusted prize for the worst in all history. From a hole protruded a family of squeezed-off turds stuck up at right angles, as if they were growing in there, like evil brown triffids. But even if you could somehow close your mind to that, there was no way you could stomach the horrific stench. There was no way I was chancing that. Instead, I tried to use my water bottle, a plastic bottle of Evian. But it filled too quickly, and I wasn't nearly done, so I rushed to the window, planning to finish off onto the dust below. The window was nailed down. Desperate now, I hobbled to a corner of the room where a section of floorboard slanted away, and I breathed a grateful sigh of relief as I finished my piss and hoped, no, prayed, that it would soak harmlessly into the wood below. But it wasn't that kind of night. Instead, my piss rained into the bar below. Kemp pissed down. I realized my mistake at the same time as an enraged shout went up below, and the next thing I knew, footsteps were thundering up the stairs towards my room. There was screaming in the corridor outside, and I imagined assault rifles and machetes being brandished as I shouted back, "Sorry! Sorry! Sorry!" TV hardman Ross Kemp here. I listened. My apologies seemed to have placated them, and they withdrew back downstairs to the film as I breathed a huge sigh of relief and took a seat on the bed. Well, I say bed. The blue thing in the room masquerading as a mattress. I sat in my pants with my head torch on, clutching my Gerber knife and listening to the mosquitoes and the sounds of the film from downstairs. Bang, bang, ha 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 ha. And I thought to myself, if I can just sleep, then things will be all right in the morning. If I can just make it through the night. It was so hot. That close, stifling heat you get at night. And I was sweating buckets, conscious I was losing fluid, and only had a fifth of a bottle of water to get me through the night. Settling on my blue mattress in the forlorn hope of getting some kip, I became aware of the noises around me. From the room next door, two guys snoring. From outside, the sounds of the jungle. Crickets, monkeys whooping, the rustle of nocturnal creatures. I'd seen the bats they have out there, and they're huge, the size of cats. I began to doze. In the next instant, I jerked awake. There was a sound. The unmistakable sound of two men moving along the corridor and tapping on a door saying, "Où est le bœuf?" and "Avez-vous le bœuf?" Despite my limited French, I knew what they were after. The beef. The corned beef. They'd seen us with it in the courtyard earlier, and now they'd come out of their room from down the corridor in search of it.
"Où est le bœuf?"
They were whispering. Don't ask me why they were whispering. There was a bit of giggling, too. I suppose it went along with the whispering. Giggling and whispering like a pair of schoolgirls. A pair of drunk or stoned schoolgirls.
"Où est le bœuf?"
They came closer to my room. I got off the mattress and went to the door, just a thin piece of wood between me and the two beef hunters.
"Où est le bœuf?"
They were outside now. Tap, tap on the door.
"Où est le bœuf?"
"No bœuf ici," I said, praying that I sounded more assertive than I felt. There was a pause.
"Avez-vous le bœuf?"
"No," I hissed back. "I mean, non. Non bœuf. Pas de bœuf." That French CSE was really coming in handy. There was a pause, and I relaxed slightly, allowing myself to believe the message had got through. That they had finally accepted my room was a birth-free zone, and that they'd returned to wherever they'd come from their own rooms or downstairs to enjoy war films on loop, wherever. Frankly, I didn't care where they went, just as long as they left the immediate vicinity of my room. Silence.
"Où est le bœuf?"
Ever seen Apocalypse Now? Colonel Kurtz losing it in the jungle. You might know that Apocalypse Now was based on a book by Joseph Conrad called Heart of Darkness, except that for the film version, Francis Ford Coppola moved the action to Vietnam from, guess where? That's right, the Congo. And here I was, having my own Colonel Kurtz Heart of Darkness moment. A desperate and unhinged man losing it in the jungle. I was starving, hungry, and dehydrated. I'd been bitten to pieces and itched all over. It was stinking hot. There was no air conditioning, nothing, not even a rickety ceiling fan. Just men with guns downstairs drinking beer? I don't know what they were drinking. It could have been human blood for all I knew. But whatever it was they were drinking, and whatever they were smoking, it was making them scary wild. So I snatched up my knife, threw open the door to my room, and charged out. Outside stood two men in jeans and short-sleeved shirts. Confronted by a man in pants with a knife and a head torch, they stopped and looked at each other, then back at me. And they backed away, holding up their hands like, "No harm meant, no problem." And off they went. I watched them retreat back down the corridor to the stairs, and only when they'd gone did I breathe a huge sigh of relief and let my knife hand relax. The following morning, I woke to the sound of drums beating up the sun. The crew were met by a strange-looking figure. Wide-eyed and still traumatized from the events of the previous evening, I'd barely slept. I was a man on the edge of sanity, dehydrated, bitten, emotionally traumatized, hungry. "Have you seen what we've got for breakfast?" said Tom. Set out in the courtyard was breakfast, which was being cooked on a skillet that resembled the upturned lid of a dustbin, and upon which a porcupine and a monkey were being roasted. Not porcupine meat and monkey meat, oh no. This was a porcupine and a monkey. All of a sudden it dawned on me exactly why the two guys last night had been so keen to get their hands on some burf. If all you've got to look forward to is porcupine and monkey, then a tin of corned beef must seem like foie gras in comparison. Still, we had a job to do, and we were going to do it. We'd made contact with a group called the Mai Mai, and were due to meet them. This was a Congolese militia group set up to defend themselves against other militias. Prior to meeting them, I was told they used child soldiers and were involved in rapes, so I was dubious about the venture, to say the least. But they turned out to be accommodating and gracious hosts. Laid on for us, at a nearby parade ground, was a traditional African welcome, although they had a few tricks up their sleeve. CL is for lost in translation. And afterwards, I spoke to a group of Mai Mai leaders, where I was told they are the enemy of the Hutu. Next, they told me something quite extraordinary. When the Mai Mai was formed, they called upon the spirits of their ancestors, who gave them the names of special herbs they could use to fight their enemies. Not only did the Mai Mai believe that the herbs made them strong, but also that if they take a solution of herbs in water, it makes them bulletproof. I put it to them that the Mai Mai had been involved in rape, and they denied it vehemently. The magic wouldn't work if we did, they claimed. It's an understatement to say that we were glad to leave Wali Kale. We could not wait to get on to that Sikorsky. But I'll leave you with two thoughts to demonstrate just how volatile and unpredictable life is in the Congo. Firstly, one of the Russian loaders helping to board the Sikorsky that day went missing. Taken by locals or militia, maybe because he was wearing a bit of gold, who knows? But he simply disappeared. The second thing is that not long after we left, members of the Mai Mai were accused of joining up with Hutu militia, raiding a village, and over a four-day period, systematically gang-raping over 200 women and children. Was it true? The same Mai Mai whose leaders had assured me that they hated the Hutu and that they would never be involved in rape because it would stop the magic working. I wondered, had the magic stopped working? B is for be careful where you... Oops, too late. Doing what I do, if you can hear the squeak of highly polished boots on highly polished floors, then it usually, if not always, means you're in a government building. Sure enough, in El Salvador in 2007, cameraman Andy Thompson and I found ourselves in a world of gleaming marble and glinting chrome as we went to interview a government official for an episode of Gangs. The building's guards wore what I can only describe as jodhpurs, tucked into boots that had been polished to an eye-watering gleam, and I was led up a flight of stairs for what turned out to be a fairly useless interview. Not only did the government official want to remain anonymous, but he wasn't keen on answering any of my questions. All in all, a waste of time. Anyway, on the way out, Andy had an idea. Why not get a shot of my crabby old shoes next to the official's shiny boots as we descended the stairs? Good idea, I said. And of course, the preening official was happy about that. So we tried to keep out of Andy's way as we began our descent of the stairs and he started to film. Now, I have the utmost respect for cameramen. Whenever people ask me about the dangerous situations I end up in, I always big up the crew, and in particular the poor old cameraman. It's a bit like that old Fred and Ginger quote, that whatever Fred was doing, Ginger was doing it backwards and in heels. Same here. Whatever I'm doing, the cameraman is doing, while holding a camera and staring into a viewfinder the size of a matchbox. Never was this more true than in El Salvador, when Andy saw the opportunity to get a great shot of a girl walking towards the camera. She had about 12 crates of eggs balanced on her head and looked angelic. It would have been a great shot, but for the fact that as he stepped back, he trod in a huge human turd. Biggest curler I've ever seen. Ugh. His fault, of course. He should never have been wearing his flip-flops or Aussie working boots, as our Australian cameraman Steve Lidgerwood calls them. Which reminds me of a time in Papua New Guinea, filming for the most recent series of Extreme World, when cameraman Jonathan Young, another fan of Aussie working boots, had a similar experience. We were in our hotel one evening when we heard the unmistakable sounds of a gunfight, accompanied by the frenzied barking of guard dogs. Grabbing our gear and rushing out, half-dressed, we realized that the gunshots had been coming from a garage forecourt nearby, and the barking belonged to the guard dogs chained to the petrol pumps. Because the dogs had got so excited, they'd crapped all over the forecourt, and I mean all over it. And as we arrived hoping to film, there was no way for Jonathan to avoid it. He stepped in more than one. Got it between his toes. Ugh. Filming at 4 a.m. in your pyjamas with dog shit stuck between your toes. Now that truly is above and beyond the call of duty. And while we're on the subject, I don't think I'll ever forget an incident during our visit to Polesmoor Prison in Cape Town. See, J is for John Mongrel. I met three transvestite prostitutes. Beyonce, who modelled herself on the real thing, Sandy, and Charmaine. They were three very funny girls, or boys, depending on your point of view. So funny, in fact, that at one point Craig Matthew, the cameraman, laughed so hard his half-moon gold-plated glasses fell off and went right into the toilet pan. Guess what was in there? That's right, something that wouldn't flush. Poor old Craig did his best to get them out. He tried using a couple of pencils like tweezers, but it was no go. He ended up leaving them there. So anyway, Andy, the same Andy who walked backwards into the turd, was doing this shot on the stairs as the director and I came down. The trouble was that Andy hadn't seen the glass panels clipped between the stair and the stair rail, and as he came back with the camera, he knocked one, and he must have given it quite a knock because one of those little star-shaped holes appeared in the glass. As we continued down the steps, I could see the crack spreading and spreading and spreading. I swear it was still making its way upstairs as we walked out of the door. That was a sticky situation. Plenty of apologies and offers to pay required to get out of that one. But fast forward a number of years to 2010, when we were making Ross Kemp in the Middle East, and there was an even more serious Watch What You're Doing incident. We were really lucky making that film. We had an amazing fixer. Often we can't name our fixers for one reason or another, mostly their own protection, and this is one such case, which makes them the unsung heroes of the films. This one in particular was beyond great. He was fantastic. How else could we have gained such incredible access to the Popular Resistance Committees, PRC, and Islamic Jihad? These were the guys who fired homemade missiles from the Strip into Israel and leave improvised explosive devices, IEDs, for Israeli troops. Getting the chance to meet them was a scoop. Nerve-wracking, but still a scoop. All the time we were in Gaza, I was convinced we were being watched. Call it paranoia if you want, but if it's all the same to you, I'll call it a case of being sensibly cautious. Anyway, there were evidently other people who thought we were being watched too. On the night we went to meet the members of the Popular Resistance Committees, PRC, a coalition of various armed Palestinian factions that oppose the conciliatory approach adopted by the Palestinian Authority and Fatah towards Israel, and who specialize in planting roadside bombs and vehicle explosive charges. We left our hotel, then had to swap vehicles 3 or 4 times before we got to the meeting location. Along for the ride were me, Tim Watts, the sound man, Andy Thompson on camera, producer Tom, director Ollie Lambert, and the fixer, translator. And we were getting more and more nervous the more car swapping we did, wondering what the hell was the point, because we were going to stand out however many times we changed cars. Next, we were told to remove the batteries from our phones, and Andy was ordered to switch off the camera. And then we waited. For over an hour, we waited, until we were greeted by a contact and told to follow a white Jeep. On we went. We arrived, in the end, at a house on a hill in Gaza, where we were greeted by a man in black combat wear, wearing a black balaclava with Arabic writing on the front. We nodded our greetings and were led through a passageway into what at first glance looked like a kitchen, and what on second glance proved to actually be a kitchen, or had been once. Only, instead of having pots and pans and Nigella Lawson standing around, it had missiles, dozens of them, lining the walls like 9 irons in a golf club shop, while in the sinks were mortars in various stages of construction. In other words, there were an awful lot of explosives in the room. There were a lot of PRC balaclava-wearing armed guys hanging around too. It didn't escape my notice that one of them was toting an M60, the big machine gun, the one Rambo uses. One of those. As ever, the leader was the smallest, most wiry guy in the room. The interview began and was a bit stilted and wary as he started to explain his ideology, and I tried to put my paranoia to one side. Not only was I worried about something in the room going off, but there was also the danger of a possible Israeli attack. Casting my eye around the room, at the missiles in tubes leaning against the walls and the mortars in the sink, it struck me that I wasn't in a kitchen so much as in a target for Israeli intelligence, either a bomb from a drone or an F-16. A quick word about sound men. Spare a thought for them. Me? I'm in front of camera, I've got the glamour job. The cameraman? Everybody respects the cameraman, because film is a visual medium. So whatever the cameraman wants, the cameraman gets. Even the director gets to stand around and give orders. But the sound man? He gets to stand there holding a boom, with everybody wondering why we don't just record the sound through the camera, like you do on your video camera at home. Qualities needed to be a sound man? Well, apart from a good ear, an aptitude for sound and atmospherics, and plenty of patience, on a purely practical level, you'd have to say that being tall helps. You need to be able to hold the boom overhead. Plus, it's not a job for shrinking violets. A sound man has to get in there, shove people aside if necessary. Like I say, they'll all be making way for the camera, but we need sound too. So he's got to be wherever the camera is to record it. Tim was the sound man in the kitchen that night. As the PRC leader and I spoke, he held the mic to catch every word we said. And he was very carefully moving the boom between us, which meant having to move back slightly. What I heard, and this will stay with me forever, was this sound. Tink. Like the sound made by a fork on a wine glass, the size of a fishbowl, the best man rising to give his speech. The room froze as the tink was followed by a clunk, and our tiny, nervy minds tried to process what was happening. Was the door about to open to Mossad agents pouring in, assault rifles chattering as they sprayed the room? Or was the tink followed by a clunk the sound you hear immediately prior to a drone strike? And then it became clear. Clunk, clunk, clunk went the missiles. Tim, the soundman, had knocked one with his boom, and it had set off a chain reaction. We watched dumbstruck as, like dominoes, the missile tubes, each one stuffed with propellant and a highly volatile homemade warhead, toppled one after the other. The guy holding the M60, I swear his eyes actually bugged out of his balaclava as we all watched the missiles fall over until it came to the very last one, the one at the end of the line, which wobbled slightly but remained upright. There was a dreadful, shocked silence in the room as we all watched the last missile settle. We swallowed, each of us suddenly realizing we'd been holding our breath. And then we looked at one another, and we burst out into hysterical laughter. And after that, the interview was a breeze. Religion, politics, race aside, even Tim laughed after saying sorry about 200 times. C is for carrier bag cavity search. Ouch. Something I've done plenty of over the years is drag my crew into various prisons, some of which have been easier to film in than others. See, P is for a prostitute called Margarita. One particular episode that sticks in my mind was in El Salvador, filming for gangs, when we spent some time with a bunch calling themselves the Little Psychopaths of Delgado City, members of MS-13, who lived on the outskirts of El Salvador's most notorious city. Initiation into MS-13 involves murdering a member of the opposing 18th Street gang, or being beaten for 13 minutes. Piss off these guys in prison, and legend has it they'll cut off your head and play football with it. So on the one hand, yes, these were tough guys. Like the rest of the gangs in El Salvador, they were always armed and, of course, heavily tattooed. Thanks to a gargantuan appetite for weed, they also spent most of their time comatose, which was either a blessing or a curse, depending on which way you looked at it. But on the other hand, they lived in grinding poverty in the barrios of San Salvador, with very few opportunities for escape, and they were scared. Not that they'd have admitted it, obviously, but they were. They lived in fear. One of them was a guy named Chucho. C.S. is also for soft toys, and it was through him that we came to be visiting the El Salvador female prison. His wife Ingrid was in there, and while imprisoned, she'd had Chucho's baby. Understandably, Chucho wanted to see his new little girl, but getting to the prison was a problem for him. As a high-ranking MS-13 member, if he was spotted on public transport, he'd either be arrested by the cops or killed by a rival gang member. There you have it. One of the pitfalls of being a known face in the gang world and not having a car. You're stuck. In other words, this was a guy in need of a lift. So we decided to set up a visit, help Chucho meet his little girl for the very first time, and get some footage as well. And the responsibility for setting all of this up fell to our researcher, Marta Shaw. A quick word about Marta. Great person. Very tough. And one of the pathfinders for Ross Kemp on Gangs. A genuine heroine of the series, and for that I thank her. One person who won't be thanking her, however, is the poor fixer Marta engaged for the purposes of getting in and out of the prison, a bloke we'll call Rolando. Being able to speak the lingo, Rolando was asked to go in and set up the visit, but it turned out to be quite an ordeal for him. He was cavity searched. The normal way of cavity searching someone is to use hygienic, disposable gloves and lubrication, but not these wardens, oh no. Whether it was a cost-cutting measure or they were unusually environmentally friendly, I don't know, but these guys used plastic carrier bags from the local supermarket. Rolando was tough, so he came through the experience unscathed and with a somewhat queasy smile on his face. The rest of the crew, that was me, the director, Anthony, the sound man, Tim Watts, and cameraman, Andy Thompson, were a slightly softer lot, and we had a nervous week of waiting to find out if we were about to be violated by carrier bags too. I'm sure it won't be that bad, I told them, wishing I could believe it. The day came and we entered the prison. Prisons have a very particular atmosphere, one you never really get used to. There's a constant noise that doesn't die down. And a smell. Difficult to describe, but really quite unpleasant. A mixture of shit, piss, BO, and detergent, if you're lucky. It's the smell of people held in confinement, and it stays in your nostrils for a long time afterwards. This prison was no different. just because the inmates were women. In many ways, of course, they were a breed apart. The women of the El Salvador gangs had an unbelievably tough time of it. Rape was a feature of involvement with the gangs, and the women would have a choice. Rape by hurt, which is what it says on the tin, or rape by love, which involves less violence but includes lots of men running a train on the poor girl and a subsequent loss of respect afterwards. That right there is pretty much a definition of a rock and a hard place. Not only that, but female gang members would be expected to deal out as much violence as their male counterparts. During my fortnight in El Salvador, I spoke to girls who were trying to leave the life and wore heavy makeup to disguise the tattoos. Lovely girls, but their casual attitude to the murders they'd committed was pretty shocking stuff. So we awaited our entrance into the prison. Nervously. Especially nervously because of the upcoming cavity search. I can't remember how we decided who would go first, but let's say that I manfully volunteered for the task. Whatever, I walked into the room where two guys were waiting for me, and without further ado, dropped my pants, thinking, might as well get it over with. The two warders looked at each other, then at me. They looked at each other again, the expressions on their faces saying, what is this mad gringo on? I stood there for a second with my pants and trousers around my ankles. They looked at me, then at each other, mouths open. Until at last the penny dropped. There was to be no carrier bag cavity search. Thank the Lord. God knows what those two blokes thought of me, dropping my trousers and standing in front of them stark bollock naked. But, breathing a sigh of relief, I hurriedly pulled up my trousers, gratefully accepted the wooden ID disc I was given, and returned to the crew. But of course, you're not going to pass up the perfect opportunity for a wind-up, are you? Oh, no. Entering the room, I rearranged my features into an expression of ashen-faced trauma, walking gingerly, like a man who just had a carrier bag shoved up his back passage. They looked at me and gulped. I think you're next, Andy, I said, indicating the poor, stricken cameraman. I'm not doing it, he quaked. You can't make me do this. I don't get paid enough for doing this. I gave him an encouraging clap on the back. Come on, mate, it's not that bad. It'll be over before you know it. Off he went, meek as a lamb. 2 minutes later, Kemp, you bastard! Once we'd collected ourselves, we passed through to the prison, where we met up with Chucho, his mother, and his wife Ingrid. There we watched as Chucho made the acquaintance of his new baby daughter, and I witnessed the other side to some of the women incarcerated in the prison, the maternal side. As for Chucho, well, I'd have to say I saw a different side to him as well. The new father and husband who was delighted to see his baby for the first time. So delighted, in fact, that while the crew and I couldn't wait to get out of the prison, Chucho stayed the night. D is for don't go jumping over people's fences, especially if you're in Belize. You'll find it on the map just below Mexico and to the right of Guatemala. And let me tell you, you have never seen such a beautiful place in your life. As well as stunning natural scenery inland, it's one of the top diving spots in the world, maybe the top, and is home to the Great Blue Hole, a huge sinkhole on the east coast, considered to be one of the world's most jaw-dropping sights. As you can probably guess, however, I wasn't there for the diving. No, I was there because Belize plays an essential part in a global cocaine trade worth over $23 billion a year. Over a third of the coke making the journey from production in South America to consumption in North America passes through there. Why? Because it's got dozens of small islands and mangroves. Not to mention miles and miles of virtually unprotected coastline and almost unguarded land borders. Of course, where you find drugs, you find crime and gangs, and Belize is no exception. Matter of fact, it's practically the world leader when it comes to crime and gangs. Great for diving it may be, but it's also a great place for getting shot, especially if you wander into some of the rougher areas of Belize City, the base for an incredible 23 gangs. We were there to film an episode of Gangs, and had landed and got to our hotel. Now, this hotel, I forget the name, but I'm not sure they'd want the kind of publicity I'm about to give them, so we'll leave it out anyway. It looked great on the outside, but once we got in, we realized it had all the usual drawbacks, which in this case included exposed wiring and the fact that they'd left the windows open in the middle of a tropical storm. Above the bed was a fan, one of those lazy things that looks good in the movies but does sweet FA in real life. Thanks to the storm blasting through the open window, it was lit up like a Christmas tree. Electricity was sparking off it and splashing to the floor. The bed, meanwhile, was awash. It was no longer a bed, it was a swimming pool. "Oh, my God," I groaned, mentally saying farewell to any chance of a good night's kip. Also on the team was Tom Watson, one of the best producers on the planet, and what rubbed salt into my shit room woe was knowing that whatever room he was in, it would be the best one. Either because he's the researcher, has a knack for it, or he's just plain lucky. But Tom Watson always gets the best room. And in general, you have to say he deserves it. So anyway, we were staying in this hotel, and after a day's shooting, we'd grab something to eat and a drink. All right, a few drinks, especially on the night in question, and make our way back to the hotel, a route that took us along the beachfront and past some really nice houses. Like everywhere you go in the world, Belize isn't a poor place if you're rich. It's only poor if you're poor, and the majority are. There was one particular house we always passed, a little scruffier than the rest. We'd been told by more than one local that it belonged to a white man who dabbled in witchcraft. Not only would this guy put a spell on you if you messed with him, but they said he'd had a wife and that he'd killed her, mummified her body, and hung her on a hook in the house. They said that if you got close enough to the house and looked through the window, you could see her desiccated corpse inside, her dead, sightless eyes staring out at you. One thing you should know about me. I don't judge. This is true personally as well as professionally. In everyday life, I hate the whole thing of being judged, people judging each other, etc. And when I'm making a film, something I always bear in mind is that there are two sides to every story. The guy in the Congo's done terrible, inhuman things. The last thing I want to do is to excuse him. But you do well to bear in mind that he's probably had terrible, inhuman things done to him or those he loves. That he's part of a horrific cycle of violence in motion. So, because of a personal bugbear, not to mention professional ethics, I try not to judge. And that goes for everything, witchcraft included. Only, I was a bit pissed, wasn't I? And I was thinking, ghosts and ghoulies, yeah, right. And as we stood there, gazing at this supposedly haunted house, I found my gaze travelling up the 7-foot-high security fence, the sort you get at basketball courts, and I thought to myself, I could make it over that. Alcohol, don't you just love it? The next thing you know, I was trying to do just that. I'd leapt up to the fence and was climbing it. The fencing rattled. The crew behind me, which included our superstitious local fixer, were going nuts, screaming at me to get back down. They had different reasons, of course. The fixer thought I was going to be cursed for the rest of my natural-born life. The crew thought I was going to do myself a mischief on the fence, especially seeing as it had lethal-looking coils of barbed wire running along the top. I wasn't about to be told, though. A mixture of booze and bravado propelled me to the top of the fence, where I negotiated the barbed wire and dropped the short distance to the neatly trimmed grass below. It was dark, and I had to admit, despite the booze and bravado, quite spooky. Every area has its haunted house, and as kids we'd broken into our local spooky home in Raynham in Essex, only to discover it was just, well, an empty house. But there was a difference between a haunted house in Essex and a haunted house in Belize, where it was dark, and where, even though it was hot, you suddenly felt a chill in the breeze that rolled off the sea. and I started to wonder if maybe climbing that fence wasn't such a good idea after all. Behind me, the crew were urging me to get my arse back over the fence pronto, but nerves or not, I'd come too far to back out now. So I ignored them and instead scooted across the lawn to the famous window.